KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Microsoft announced its long-awaited reorganization yesterday. Seattle's mayoral primary may finally be heating up. We're going to talk about these stories and more after 10 o'clock with our panel of journalists. And coming up later this hour, soccer star Megan Rapinoe will be here. You may be following the ongoing efforts to reform the Seattle Police Department. Those efforts stem from U.S. Justice Department findings of undue forced and biased policing. Now it looks like the King County Sheriff's Office is under the microscope. And joining me to explain what's going on is KUOW's Amy Radel, who follows law and justice. This stems, as I understand it, Amy, from a particular incident last year.
That's right. We've just heard a report looking at how the department responded to an officer-involved shooting that happened in 2012 near Auburn. A deputy with the King County Sheriff's Office and a corrections officer went to serve a warrant on a man who was a felon who hadn't followed the terms of his probation. And they walked into the house. They saw him right away, and they took him and they handcuffed him without incident. That part went very smoothly. So after that, they decided to look around the house, make sure there were no firearms, since that was part of his agreement.
Okay.
So what the incident that now has come with this big review was when they went into the basement and ran into another man. Dustin Theo Harris is his name. This was a King County Sheriff's deputy, and who they went in. He had a flashlight mounted on his gun, so that kind of one of the only sources of light was this flashlight on the gun. Okay. And they went in. There was a guy. He was sleeping in the bed. They seemed to have some kind of confused conversation about whether he may have had a gun. And they thought he was reaching for something. And at that point, they opened fire. They shot him, I think, about 15 times. Amazingly, he survived this. Mm. And now there's just been a lot of scrutiny of why did this happen? How did this happen? How has the sheriff's department responded? And he's suing. He's already reached a settlement with the county, Mr. Theo Harris, and he's suing the state for $20 million.
Wow. Who did the investigation into the incident?
So the King County, the Sheriff's Department has an Office of Law Enforcement Oversight, kind of like the OPA, if you follow things in Seattle, that looks at, okay, how do we look at these things after the fact? And that office brought in Merrick Bobb, who's the court-appointed monitor in Seattle. So we hear his name a lot. And whenever he talks about the Seattle Police Department, it's very high visibility. It carries a lot of weight. He's in charge of making sure Seattle follows the terms that the DOJ has set out. So over in King County, his same group reviewed the aftermath of the shooting, and that's what was presented this week to the county council.
And what did they find?
So every review has found that the shooting of Mr. Theo Harris was lawful. It was within procedures. The sheriff's department, the prosecutor's office, and now this group as well. But they raised what they called some serious deficiencies in the investigation. They were very concerned about some of the ways that evidence was overlooked or moved around, not tracked. And they said that there was this unwillingness. The big issue they found was the sheriff's department would not question these officers who were involved. And there's a lot of policy around that. But there was just this kind of absence of a willingness to get their side. And you have these investigators coming in who are supposed to look at anything important. They haven't heard from the officers about what just happened. How can they look at the room, the evidence, when they have no idea what just happened there?
Well, so this is interesting, but is it a one-off occurrence as far as the county sheriff's department?
This particular circumstance, there were some things. This was a joint operation with the corrections department, and Sheriff Urquhart has said they're going to suspend that cooperation while they sort some of this out. So that may have been kind of one of the specific things. But there are some big issues that came out in this oversight report that I think are broader. One of them was they talked about how there just seems to be a tilt of all the policies at the sheriff's department in favor of the officers, in favor of the deputies, and to the point of worrying about reducing trauma for them, caring for them in these situations, to the exclusion of civilian witnesses, crime victims. And so this is kind of this huge umbrella issue of all this policy language is talking about, okay, we need to make sure that the deputies are okay in an officer-involved shooting. Another issue is the neutrality of a supervisor. The first sergeant on the scene, the first supervisor to arrive, came in, and he immediately said, okay, I'm here to advocate for the officer. Mm. And so they said, you can't do that. If you're the first supervisor, you need to be neutral and look at all the angles of this.
Now, you mentioned Sheriff Urquhart. He has been in the job since he was elected in November. Essentially, he took office on January 2nd, I assume. So he hasn't been at this very long. How might this, or even has it, changed since he's taken over?
So this didn't happen on his watch, as you point out. He's more recent. He said he's very concerned about it. And one of the big issues that he wants to tackle is the department's failure to question the deputies and get their version much more quickly. The Merrick Bobbs group says you need to talk to the deputies face-to-face in a recorded interview. That's the ideal. As soon as possible that night. They let the deputy submit a written statement after a month had passed. So think about all the details that you retain and how long you retain them. And they didn't actually question him face to face until 7 months later. So you just think about how things. And so he really wants to work on this. It's a union issue, of course. The deputy could have requested a delay up to 72 hours, but still, to let it go for a month shows that this was beyond what the union stipulates.
It sounds like these are major structural issues in addition to this particular incident, right?
These go far beyond it. And it gets into contract negotiations. And that's an area, this is an important difference with Seattle, where Sheriff Urquhart has basically sole authority. He's elected, and we voted in a ballot measure, which maybe people were reading closely or maybe not, in 2010, to also give the sheriff the authority to negotiate the labor agreements. We removed that authority from the county executive. And so structurally, it just means that the county executive and the county council are really removed from this. And we don't have that same kind of marching on City Hall that we had in Seattle when John T. Williams was shot, because people don't really associate them with the performance of the sheriff's office.
So what it sounds like you're describing is a department, a powerful department, that has little accountability at this point to either public officials or to the citizenry.
Well, the sheriff is elected.
So we could vote him out.
Yeah, so we can vote him out. And, some people have mentioned that as a solution in Seattle when they have felt frustrated with how the police department in Seattle has performed. But it's interesting to see Mayor McGinn be so front and center with everything about policing in the past couple of years. Seeing these reports just is an interesting insight into how King County is so different. It's so spread out. They're working, in 12 different cities. I mean, this is a very kind of disparate force. And so Sheriff Urquhart really wants to, bring some changes coming out of this experience, I think.
Did he set out any kind of timeline for this structural change?
So far, I think part of it is the union, the contract negotiations. Some things have already been implemented as far as how detectives come into the crime scene. And, they responded to some of the recommendations from Merrick Bobb. Other things will probably take longer to sort out.
KOW's Amy Radel covers law, justice, and other governmental issues. Thank you for stopping in to explain this for us.
You're welcome.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
In a minute here, the latest in biotech science. We'll hear about a company that's working on a new treatment for migraines. That's just moments away.
Support for KUOW comes from King County Solid Waste Division, encouraging families to reduce household garbage by one bag a month. Junk mail, pop cans, plastic tubs, and bottles can be recycled. Online pledge at kingcounty.gov/recyclemore.
59 degrees in Seattle. It's mostly cloudy this morning, but the forecast says it's going to turn partly sunny later, and we expect to reach 71 for today's high. 9:16. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A conversation with soccer star Megan Rapinoe in 15 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. On Fridays, we try to take a little time to check in on news from the scientific community. And back with us in the studios is Luke Timmerman, National Biotech Editor for Xconomy. And welcome back and down, because you were up climbing Mount McKinley.
That's right.
All right. We'll talk about that in a little bit. I was most interested about something that you sent us, which is that there's a local company in Bothell that is looking at new ways to treat migraines. And as somebody who has suffered from migraines off and on, I'm most curious to know what they're thinking about.
Yeah, well, this is a really fascinating story because there are millions of people in the U.S. that suffer from chronic migraines, 10, 15, sometimes 20 a month. They've been treated traditionally with this class of drugs called triptans, which basically constrict the blood flow to the brain. But they have some disadvantages. They can only be taken after the symptoms appear. So
you've already got your migraine.
You've already got a problem. And they don't work for everybody. And they can't be taken really chronically because they have side effects, like they can increase your blood pressure.
Okay.
So these drugs have been around a long time. They've gone generic. Scientists haven't really come up with good mechanisms to come up with new drugs. But interestingly, Merck, the big drug maker, sort of validated a new pathway, as they say, a new target called CGRP.
And what does that stand for?
Oh, it's calcitonin gene-related peptide, if you really want to know.
I don't even know what that is. It sounds like something genetic. The word gene is in there.
But essentially what is important here is that it's involved in that migraine process. So if you turn off this switch, so to speak, you can halt the migraine, maybe even prevent it from starting in the first place.
As I understand it, different people have different causes behind their migraines. You know, some are hormone related, others are optical. In other words, it's like cancer. It's a disease that has a lot of different root causes. So I'm curious how this is something that they're thinking can span all kinds of migraines?
We don't know that for sure yet. It's still early in the clinical trials, but the hope is that yes, that this does seem to be an integral process to migraine.
And this is something that would be preventive rather than treating a symptom.
Correct. So as I mentioned, Merck came up with this drug that appeared to prove that this target is worthy. Their drug was able to, in clinical trials, reduce the number of migraine headaches that a chronic sufferer had per month. But it had a problem, and that was it caused liver toxicity.
That is a big problem.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not something you're willing to accept for a chronic condition like migraine. So other companies like this one here in Seattle, Alder Biopharma, said, well, wait a minute. If we can come up with a better way to hit this target without causing the liver toxicity, we could have a really good drug. And so they've come up with an antibody that's injectable. So this is different than a pill in a bottle. And it lasts in your bloodstream for as long as a month. So by having a drug that stays active in your bloodstream for that long, it actually can prevent migraines from occurring.
So where are they in the process of testing?
They've passed an initial safety study and shown that it's absorbed and distributed the way they want it in the body. So now it's entering the real test, the proof of concept in 160 patients. Half of them who are getting a placebo, half who are getting the experimental drug.
That's Alder Biopharmaceuticals, which is based in Bothell. And we are talking with Luke Timmerman of Xconomy, another Seattle company, Adaptive Biotech, which is, as I understand, Fred Hutchinson Center spinoff, is working on something called immune profiling, which sounds very CSI, but what is immune profiling and who is this company?
Well, it helps to understand just a little bit about the genome and the Human Genome Project, as you remember, right?
I do.
We know that a genome basically provides the unique recipe that makes all the cells in an individual human being. And it's fixed. Mm-hmm. It's constant from when we're born all throughout life. Interestingly, though, that's not true for every cell type in the body. In our immune system, we have what they call B and T cells that that adapt to pathogens like bacteria, viruses that we encounter. They reshuffle around that DNA in the genome and all kinds of interesting ways.
So people may have heard of T cells in relationship to HIV because that's something that researchers and physicians look for is T cell counts for patients who have that, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
And so a B cell is something similar to a T cell?
Yeah. B cells are what form antibodies.
Okay.
So that defend us from...
Okay. So we have this unchanging set of genes except for that these particular kinds of cells do change.
That's right. So you could go have your genome sequenced today and that will tell a scientist something about you, but it won't tell them how your immune system is necessarily adapting to all the things that you've encountered in the environment.
Okay.
And so, and scientists have never really had a good way to look at an individual's immune profile or their immune repertoire, as they say. And this is what adaptive biotechnologies does.
So they're going to be able to tailor something to look at me personally, what I might be immune to or what I might be susceptible to based on my individual my genes and a count of T and B cells.
That's one possible use, but this being a company, they have to figure out, more than just scientific curiosities. They're thinking about what are the commercial applications, and one of them that occurred to them was what they call, it's a diagnostic use for patients, say, who have gone through leukemia or lymphoma treatment. They get a whole lot of chemotherapy or radiation. Immediately, the doctor wants to know afterward, did we get all the cancer or not? And you can count the T or B cells that are left. Like if there are too many of a certain kind of cell, that's a sign of cancer. But this immune profiling test is much more sensitive because it's looking deeper at the genome. So they can tell whether you've got what they call minimal residual disease, a little bit left in there. And then the doctor can decide, do we want to be more aggressive and give you another round of chemo, or should we just watch and wait?
So do they sell this immune profiling to a drug company? Who buys it if we're talking about commercial prospects?
It's not quite ready for the market just yet for that use. It's coming. But right now they are selling this service to pharmaceutical companies who want to use this information to help them understand who's responding or not, or is likely to respond or not in clinical trials.
Wow. Well, that sounds like high science. I'm going to bring it back now to something that actually I can wrap my brain around, which is a new technology that allows physicians and healthcare professionals to remotely monitor shunts. So tell us what a shunt is.
Yeah, so it's a very simple tool. It's been around forever. It's basically a tube and a valve that drains excess fluid off the brain. In case sometimes patients have traumatic brain injury, they need a shunt put in to relieve that pressure. If that pressure builds up, you got a problem. Also happens for kids with hydrocephalus. And so the problem here is that these things clog up. And that causes the pressure to build up and you have swelling and you have problems. Doctors have never really had a way to detect this. You know, they just have the patient come in on scheduled visits. And
so it could get clogged up or even worse, sort of infected with something in the interim time when the patient sees the doctor and comes back for a follow-up visit.
That's right. And for patients with hydrocephalus, it's very predictable. They know that these shunts are going to clog up after a certain period of time. And what it leads to are repeat surgeries. You have a surgery to remove it and you put a new one in. And it's just really hard on people.
So there's a company, another local company called Aqueduct Neurosciences, and they're looking at a way to
for the healthcare provider to remotely tell if there's a problem.
Yeah, I guess you could call this a smart shunt. You know, if you've heard of the smart grid,
right?
You know, we can monitor your electricity usage remotely.
Sure.
Same kind of thing. You've got a sensor attached to this shunt, and it can detect when pressure is building up and send a signal to your handheld device, tells your doctor, hey, my patient has some pressure buildup. We need to bring them in and have it drained.
Well, that sounds like a great and practical thing.
Yeah, it's one of these simple innovations. You wonder why hasn't anybody done this before?
I noticed that this particular company, Aqueduct Neurosciences, is a University of Washington spin-off. The one Adaptive Biotech, which was the Immune Profilers, is a Fred Hutch spinoff. And I get the sense that South Lake Union and the environs in this central city are just like constantly fermenting with these spinoffs and new ideas that folks are generating.
Certainly, that's where a lot of the big ideas come from.
Interesting. Okay, I introduced you by saying you had climbed Mount McKinley, which some people call Denali. I know that you did that. And the last time you were here, which is a while ago at this point, we were talking about something that sounded very space age. But so I want you to talk about what you took up to the top of the mountain with you.
Well, I didn't carry it in my backpack, but it's a handheld ultrasound machine. It's basically ultrasound on a smartphone. And
an app.
Yeah. So this is a local company. We have a great ultrasound tradition here in the Seattle area. So the latest iteration. As I was working my way up McKinley at one of the main camps, I came across a group of Stanford University researchers who were assessing the health of climbers at this stage of the game and trying to understand what kind of stress they might be under physically and maybe how that might translate for people with respiratory diseases.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they did, I mean, there were a whole battery of tests, right? I mean, we did a walking test and they took our blood oxygen levels. But one of the things they did was they gave us a quick ultrasound. And looking at the rate of blood flow from in our vena cava, I believe. So it's like the blood that comes from your legs back to your heart.
And they were using this smartphone ultrasound for this?
Yeah. I asked them, being a biotech reporter, right. I said, what tool are you using? And they said, oh, it's the Mobisante. Well, sure enough, that's something I've written about.
So you just ran across it by accident? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And of course, I had to ask them, well, how does it do?
How did it do?
They loved it. Number one, because it was light. Uh-huh. So they had to carry it. It's a couple pounds. But it produced high quality images. And, you know, they were able to send them back to their fellow researchers at Stanford.
Via phone.
Yeah.
So this hooks up to your phone. It's not actually an app. It's not a downloadable, you know, ultrasound app or anything like that.
That's right. It's a specially built smartphone with ultrasound capability.
So it's not going to go on like my iPhone or something like that.
No. And you'd have to spend extra money for a ultrasound probe, and it'll cost you about $10,000. I don't know if you're ready for that.
I don't think I am ready for that, although I guess I'm glad that you ran across this group of researchers. I'm curious, how did you do with all that testing? Did you pass?
I don't know yet. I need to complete the study, but I did summit.
That's a good thing. How did you feel? I guess I'll ask the old school medical query. You feel okay at the top there?
I felt pretty good. I felt good on the way up, but you know, I don't know how much blood oxygen I had at that point and whether I was dehydrated. And so they're going to look at all those things and try to, you know, predict whether or not. To use that to predict whether I would summit or whether others in that kind of condition would be able to summit.
That's amazing. I'm just imagining we'll talk to you in a year and it'll be some kind of little chip. Everything will just be, you know, in your backpack because it's all going to be so super light that you're going to be able to do this yourself.
Well, that might be too easy.
Luke Timmerman is the National Biotech Editor for Xconomy and a mountain climber. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Marcy.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
.931. Soccer star Megan Rapinoe is known for her crafty style of play. At least that's what it says on her Wikipedia page. The crafty Megan Rapinoe joins us in a minute here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 58 degrees right now and mostly cloudy. Forecast says it'll be partly sunny this afternoon, getting up into the low 70s.
The woman was on the ground and the bull was tossing her in the air and back on the ground.
And where were you?
I was right on the other side of the fence, but the fence was electric.
Why is it that certain people will risk their lives for a stranger?
I went ahead and just climbed through the fence.
While others won't.
My neighbors would not help me.
That question this week on Radiolab.
Tonight, 7 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Delta Dental, with a wide provider network that includes nearly 90% of Washington State dentists. More information and a list of participating dentists are available at deltadentalwa.com.
9:32, the latest on Edward Snowden's quest for asylum in 30 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. They say that if at first you don't succeed, try again. And when it comes to creating a professional women's soccer league in this country, fans and sponsors hope the third time is going to be the charm. The National Women's Soccer League, NWSL, debuted this year. Seattle area fans hope the local team, the Reign FC, will become the kind of draw that the Sounders have been on the men's side of soccer. One of the big names on the Reign roster, former national team and Olympic team player Megan Rapinoe, who is in our studios today. It's a great honor to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
You actually joined the team after the season was in progress because you've been playing in France.
I have, yeah. I came in about halfway through the season, just got off my season in France. I played a half a season there, came right in and kind of fit in with the team right away.
It's Lyon, France, that you were playing in.
Yeah.
How long were you there?
I was there from January until June, so about 6 months.
And is that their... Do they have 6 month seasons, or was the intent that you were going to stay there, but then this came up and you came here?
I came mid season for them. So their season really is 10 months long, goes from September, beginning of September to the end of June. And that was the duration of my contract just until then. So I finished up my duties there and then got back to our domestic league.
You're done in France.
I don't know if I'm done, but you're done for the season.
Well, what enticed you to Seattle to play for the Reign?
I'm from Northern California originally, but I went to school in Portland and from the Northwest. So obviously to keep here, I think this is the best coast, and I think this is the best area of the country. This is obviously where I'd choose to live, but I played here a little bit last year during the summer. Just the atmosphere up here. I think in Portland and Seattle, some of the best football atmospheres that we have in the country. It just seems sort of organic within the people and within kind of the society. And it's cool to have that and to really have that football experience that you would have in Europe.
You've been playing since you were a small child, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, it's been almost 23 years now, which makes me feel very old.
When did you know you were good?
When I know I was good, I think later on in high school. I think I was a late bloomer. I'm a twin, and my sister was always much better than me. I was always pretty like small and scrawny. But I think sort of midway through high school, I started getting called into the national team, and I think then I was kind of like, oh, okay, maybe I can do this. You know, I think before then it was just something that I loved to do and something that we both loved to do. But then it was kind of this could potentially be something more serious.
You know, it seems that female athletes, high school, and the path is college for most of you because mm-hmm. it's not like guys who are
great at sports in high school,
right.
that there's a clear professional path. So when you realized you were good, when you started getting tapped by the national team, what were you imagining would be your future athletically?
First, just to go to college. I'm from, you know, pretty humble family in Reading and didn't have a ton of money growing up. So to be able to go to college and have that paid for it and get a scholarship, that was huge. I think once I got into college, I kind of started realizing there might be a professional future and something that you could actually make a living for. But I think before that, it was just like, oh my God, we're going to go to college. And, you know, we get to have that experience and to go relatively close to home, which was nice.
So you and your sister went together?
We did. Yeah. We went together to University of Portland.
And you both played soccer there?
Both played soccer. Yeah.
And is she playing now still?
She's done now. Yeah, she's done now. She played professionally a little bit after college, but she hung the boots up.
And is she happier for that?
She is. She is happier. She liked it, but didn't love it.
So for female collegiate athletes, what happens next if you're good? Because we've watched, as I mentioned introducing you, there have been many efforts to try to start professional leagues in soccer. There is a professional basketball league at this point, but financially, it's not the same avenue that if you're a guy who plays, for example, for the University of Washington, you get drafted. We're looking at really different kinds of lifestyles.
Right.
So what options face you? Did somebody sit you down and say, Megan, if you really want to do this, here's what you're going to have to do?
Yeah. When I came out, I was lucky. I was sort of in the time period. The last league, WPS, was just starting up. So I was able to come right out of college and play. And that's the option now. We have this league. And I really do think that it's sustainable. We have, you know, kind of collaborative efforts between the Canadian, the Mexican, and the U.S. federations backing that. And I think that they have a very strong vested interest in that.
So essentially what they're doing is each of those federations is putting in money to pay the salaries of a group of players that are part of the pot of players, right?
Right, yeah. Those federations are sending the players that they want to play in the league and essentially paying those salaries so the burden doesn't fall on the clubs.
How does it work in France, for example?
In France, it's every club is just its own entity. So our club is just under the umbrella of the overall Olympic Lyonnais club, and we're in tight conjunction with the men as well.
Is it more popular, women's soccer, than it is here?
No, I don't think women's soccer is more popular in France than it is here. The team I play on in Lyon is very popular, and it's one of the best club teams in France. So in that aspect, it's very popular. But still, I think the popularity here with the success of the national team in the last, you know, 2 or 3 years has just been insane. I was on it before the World Cup, and just to see sort of the meteoric rise of not only the team, but interest in women's soccer has just been unbelievable.
When I ask people about you, and we're talking with Megan Rapinoe, who is a midfielder, I believe.
Yes.
That is your position. When I ask people about you, you know, what's your greatest thought about this soccer player? They talk about the semifinal against Brazil in the 2011 World Cup. You set up a header that Abby Wambach scored on, but I want you to talk about that because this is in, like, I think the second overtime, if I'm right about that.
Yes. The whole game was quite crazy. Hot day in Dresden, I'll set the scene. We had gotten a red card like in the 50th minute or the 55th minute. So we played down a player for the majority of the game. Ended up being we played down longer than we played with the full squad. Double overtime. A penalty that Hope saved and ended up getting called back.
They Hope Solo again. We're talking about.
Yep, yeah. Hope Solo. And it was literally the dying moments of the game. I think the only reason there was extra time added on is because one of their players went down with a phantom injury. And I think the rep, and she subsequently sprinted back on the field. So I think she was fine. But yeah, won it in our end. The whole team traveled the ball up, and then I would love to say that it was completely intentional and I saw Abby running, but I didn't. It was just like the dying moments. We're about to be exited from the World Cup. I think the earliest that we had ever been, and I just had to get something on it, and Abby does what she does best and scores the biggest goals in
so
the world.
So you were hoping that she would get this ball?
Yeah, very much so, hoping. I didn't know that she was there specifically, but you know, she's always in there. So I knew she was going to be just around the general vicinity and just try to get get something on it. If she doesn't score on that, I think the whistle's blown and probably not sitting here.
Huh. How many World Cups have you played in?
Just one.
Just that one.
Just one, yeah.
Are you will, I'm assuming, will play in 2015?
I am hoping.
Body willing?
Yeah, body willing and with the blessings of our coach, Tommy.
Who are other teams, I guess, other countries? I mentioned Brazil. I think Japan has a reputation as a really strong team. But but who are the Americans, the major challengers to the U.S. team?
I think it's becoming much more these days. I think, you know, in the past maybe 10 years, it's sort of been the usual suspects. Germany's always very strong. France is sort of... surged in the last, I would say, 3 or 4 years. I think that league there has really helped their national team. Japan, always. Sweden, Brazil is always in the mix. I think those are sort of the top, you know, top 4 or 5 teams in the world.
Where do you rank the Americans, objectively, if you can?
Objectively? I think we've earned the spot that we have now, which I think is number one. I think that we've sort of proven that we can be there, but also stay there and stay consistent. And I think, you know, with the new coach, we've made a lot of changes and there's been a lot of different lineups, but we still kind of kept that fighting spirit and kept the level that we hold to ourselves.
How does the U.S. style of play differ from some of those more traditional powerhouses?
I think historically, we've been a bit more physical. We've kind of relied on our physical strength in sort of our athleticism. But I think now we're beginning to couple that with some really, really crafty and technical play and kind of tactically breaking down teams as well. But we still have that sort of undying American spirit. We're very, very hard to beat. And I think that's something that other countries know. And we know how to win. And if you beat us, you're going to have to earn it. And I think that that's something that we still have over a lot of countries.
We're talking with Seattle Reign footballer Megan Rapinoe. Footballer is the word, right?
The proper term,
footballer. And there's a great profile of you in the New York Times several months ago talking about when you arrived in Lyon to play with your new team. And one of the comments they said about you was that you were smaller. You just talked about Americans' athleticism. In fact, you're not huge, you know, you don't look like some, you know, giant Amazon when you walk in the door. Is that what the reputation of the U.S. is, as sort of like big girls with big muscles?
Yeah, I think I know they think that we're a lot bigger than we actually are. I'm actually taller than quite a few of the players on the team.
Really?
I'm taller than most of the players in the back line, which I just found out recently. I was like, no way I'm taller than you. But I think that we're tough and we are strong and we're not afraid to get into tackles and to sort of play that physical style. And I think that, I guess we have that big presence, which is intimidating and a good thing.
You were recruited out of the 2012 Olympics to this team in France, right?
I think so, yeah.
I mean, recruited might not be the right word.
No, but. I think that's fair. I think that the coaches, I think maybe they saw me a little bit the year before, but definitely in the Olympics. I would say that's the best that I've ever played. So it's
well, and you guys did well. What was it? The idea of living in France that was attractive, or was it that there was we were sort of in a lull between professional leagues in this country?
I think it was sort of perfect storm of everything. We were sort of in a lull. I knew that the league was starting back up, but not until April or May that we would be able to start games. The idea of living overseas has always been something that's very enticing to me. I was hoping to learn some French, which I learned a little bit, but I'm not sure if it's even correct. And then obviously getting to couple that whole experience and that whole, I guess, lifestyle with playing with one of the best clubs in the world and challenging myself that way. It was sort of the perfect storm of goodness for me.
It's not a secret that you are an out lesbian in the
isn't it?
It's not. I'm sorry.
No.
Did I just spill the beans?
No.
From what I've heard, mostly your fan base has been pretty accepting of that. Was that true in Europe as well?
Yeah, it was. I think for women, it's much different. The climate is much different than for men in Europe and really all over the world. But yeah, unless I'm just blind negativity, I really haven't seen or heard or felt kind of any sort of anti-gay or negative feelings about it.
Do you feel any pressure to be sort of a spokeswoman or some kind of role model that you might not feel if you were more private about your personal life?
Maybe. I don't see it as pressure in a negative way. I think it's a good thing. I mean, I think that, you know, even just in the last year, we've had Robbie Rogers come out. We've had Jason Collins come out. I've come out in the last year. I think it's a great thing. Obviously, with the SCOTUS decisions lately, I feel like these tides are turning and these, I guess, these sort of bigoted walls are falling down. And it's really cool to be a part of. And I'm proud that I am who I am, and I'm proud to be gay. It's not the only part of me, but I'm proud to be able to have the platform that I do and to be able to, you know, hopefully, I guess, change things for the better.
You're living in a state where gay marriage is legal.
Yeah, I am.
Does that entice you to stay here?
In a way, yes, but I feel pretty soon that all states will be legal. I'm not ready to be married yet.
So. You still got some footballing to do.
Time, yeah.
Megan Rapinoe's with us, and she's playing with Seattle Reign FC, which is in its infancy. But as I mentioned, this is the third time around. You talked about the support from various soccer federations around the world. How confident are you this time that the league can make it beyond a couple seasons?
I'm really confident. I think much more confident than the last leagues. The last leagues, the federations weren't involved. And I think this time the federations understand how important it is to have their players playing year-round, first of all, and to have a league here in the U.S. when the popularity of soccer here is growing so rapidly.
Do you think that there are any kind of sort of social or cultural changes that need to take place in the U.S. to make women's soccer, I guess any women's professional sport, a more viable and sort of more mainstream than it is?
I think a little bit, but I think with the popularity of the national team, we're getting 25,000+. We sold out Wembley in England for the Olympics and, you know, in the World Cup in Germany before the stadiums were packed. So I think that people just need to know that it exists and have the ability to find out when the games are, because I think people really do genuinely enjoy watching women's soccer. And just as the culture of soccer grows in the U.S. as it is, we're a little bit spoiled here in the Northwest with the Sounders and the Timbers. They've just absolutely smashed the MLS. It's been brilliant. So I think, you know, as that grows as well, then we'll just follow right up with that.
There are a bunch of little girls that come to all your games.
Yeah, little girls, tons of them. Little boys.
Some.
Men, women. It seems it sort of crosses a lot of different paths with people.
So how long is the duration of this particular contract with the Reign for you?
This will go to the end of the season. It's a little bit tricky because our contracts are with the federation. So
okay.
It's sort of a dual contract. So I'll be able to go back and play next year. But if I come back, then I'll be obligated to play with the Reign, which is
so go back thing. Next year to play
in France. Yeah.
So that's the plan right now. You're here till the end of the season.
I'm thinking about it. Yeah. It's
are you not planning at all more than a month ahead of time?
I am planning, but there's a lot of things that I have to consider. So it was a wonderful experience last year and I really enjoyed it. But we'll see.
So the only firm thing is that you're going to be a footballer, at least for the near future.
Yes, I will continue doing that.
I'm just trying to pin you down. Megan Rapinoe plays midfield for the Reign FC in the first season of the National Women's Soccer League. They're going to play a televised match this Sunday. Coincidentally, it's Bastille Day, so you can have that joint sort of France-U.S. kind of thing.
Perfect.
The game is at 5:38 on Fox Soccer, and it's at home versus the Washington Spirit. And by the way, it's the first nationally televised NWSL match, so good luck.
Thank you very much. And just a quick thing, go to Reign FC. You type in Megan, M-E-G-A-N. There's a promo code, and it's $10 grandstand seat. So it's shaded. It's in sort of the big part of the stadium. I'm going to be a hot ticket.
You heard it here first. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me on.
This is Weekday.
And now.
This is the sound of the week. The sound of the week.
That sound is from Captain John Arnold. He was the Puget Sound pilot on the Costco Antwerp, which is a container ship bound for Pier 18-3 in Seattle. Captain Mei Yong Kwan from Shanghai sent a man down to the engine room to record the sounds of the Antwerp's 10-cylinder, 58,600-horsepower engine, just to be specific, Bernard.
Wow.
Yeah, it is amazing. Captain Arnold said 10 years ago, the ship with a maximum load of 5,400 20-foot containers was considered large, but right now it's a medium-sized container ship.
I love the fact that they sent someone down to make a recording just to send it to us, I presume.
Of course. Why not? And we do need sounds. Our producers are clamoring for them. So whether you're on a giant container ship like Captain John Arnold, or maybe you're sitting with your kitten under a tree looking at the flowers, record 30 seconds of what you're listening to and send that sound to us along with the story behind the sound. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and please include sound of the day in the subject line, and we'd love to play it no matter where you are, because it takes us. Certainly, Bernard, you and I have not gone down into the hold of a container ship.
I have not.
You might have, I realize.
I bet that would be interesting, though.
Yeah, as I was saying that, I thought, well, maybe Bernard has. He's got a wild man background. Okay, from the container ships to the weather, the weekend is here, and it's time to check in with Washington State climatologist Nick Bond. And Nick, it was overcast last I looked, but I'm hearing that we might see some sunshine.
Yeah, today is definitely going to be a cool day, and these aren't just marine clouds that can burn off in the afternoon, but they're kind of mid-level and high-level ones there. They're even producing some precipitation aloft that's not reaching the ground yet. There is even chance for a sprinkle, especially on the west side of the sound. But yeah, so today, just the upper 60s, maybe lower 70s, but a mostly sunny weekend, mid-70s on Saturday, upper 70s on Sunday, and kind of that upward trend continuing into early next week with low 80s on Monday and probably mid-80s on Tuesday.
I just have to go back to that thing about producing rain aloft. If it doesn't come down to the ground and it's raining, where does it rain?
Well, it evaporates.
Oh.
Before it gets there, before it gets to the ground. And it can be kind of tricky. You can look at the radar and see there are these echoes and go, well, shoot, it's got to be raining. But none of the stations are reporting that. It doesn't mean that we won't get a very light sprinkle or two, but probably not, and it'll be no more than an annoyance, if that.
Yesterday morning there in the north end of Seattle where I live, there was some sort of, you could either call it heavy mist or very, very light rain. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, well, these will, yeah, that was probably more from the kind of low clouds. You know, it's kind of getting into geek territory here, but we're talking actually about, you know, raindrops themselves, not just kind of drizzle.
Okay.
But it's not really a big threat. And the mountains, they have a, you know, greater chance of it. But again, this is not going to be much of anything, and we're looking for a pretty nice weekend.
Okay, well, I'll keep that in mind. I have to ask you, a few weeks ago, maybe about a month or so ago, we had somebody in here talking about the planetary alignment, what they called the dance of the planets, and it was unfortunate here because we had clouds at night, and so mostly we weren't able to see the alignment of these three bright planets that were very close to us. And I'm wondering if there is, at this point, an accurate way to know when it might be clear at night, because sometimes it's clear in the day, and then all of a sudden we have clouds.
Yeah, that's right. And I found out about this website, and first of all, it is very difficult to forecast clouds. That's something that we have, you know, just a lot of problem. Our computer models just aren't that good at it. But I was told about this site kind of set up for amateur astronomers called cleardarksky.com.
One word,
clear dark sky. And it provides two-day forecasts of cloud and other conditions related to stargazing. It's based on an output from a computer model run by the equivalent of the Weather Service in Canada. And it's reasonably straightforward to use and find out, you know, wherever you want, what it's going to be like. I'm interested in seeing how well, it does, on admittedly an informal basis, because again, it is a tough forecast to get right. But for, you know, listeners who are kind of interested in that sort of thing, they might want to check it out.
Why is it so hard to predict if we're going to have clouds at night or in day?
Yeah, it's a very complicated set of processes that range on scales from thousands of kilometers to micrometers in terms of you can see on some days the wisps of clouds kind of go away and appear just, and for our models just have a hard time handling all the processes that go on into the formation and dissipation of clouds. And this is on timescales of the next day to decades from now. And so it's something we're trying to get better at all the time, and especially from a kind of climate perspective, we want to know this because how the climate change is going to play out is very much dependent on the clouds.
Is it more difficult here in the Northwest than it is, say, in the Midwest of the U.S.?
Perhaps so, because we're so much plagued by these low marine clouds. And, you know, how soon are they going to burn off in the afternoon? That's going to make a tremendous difference, whether it's going to be just in the low 70s or get into the 80s, let's say. And, again, very subtle differences in wind patterns and kind of the overall structure of the atmosphere can make all the difference about whether they last all day or just kind of go away by mid-morning.
I'm going to leave you with a question that I was thinking about this morning. I get up really early and go rowing on Lake Union usually, and I've noticed that the early morning wind is coming from a different direction than it normally does. It's been coming from the northeast, east-northeast, which is unusual for summer, just in my experience of being out there. So I set that task to you to explain to me that we've talked about the afternoon north winds, but we haven't talked about morning winds. So
yeah, there we have documented there's a kind of a clockwise rotation of the winds over the course of the day. And so your observations are very insightful. There tends to be kind of an easterly component to the winds, cooler air over the Cascades sort of kind of goes downslope into the Puget Sound lowlands, and so kind of brings an easterly component during the late night and early morning, and then the hot air over the Cascades kind of rising there draws in, so it's more westerly in the afternoon, and sometimes those changes can be overwhelmed by, you know, storm systems coming in and that sort of thing. But we see in the averages just what you mentioned, that a tendency for that easterly flow in the early morning.
I'm looking for the sweet spot when it all calms down. Nick Bond is Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He's with us every Friday with a weather outlook for today. Not so great, but clearing up and warmer over the weekend. Thanks so much, Nick.
Yeah, you got it.
Have a great weekend.
It's 9:59. Did you feel the earth move this morning? There were a couple of small earthquakes earlier today. KUOW's Lisa Brooks will tell us more in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Irritable Bowel Syndrome Treatment Center, specializing in IBS, gluten sensitivity, celiac disease, and related digestive problems. Details on customized IBS solutions at ibstreatmentcenter.com or on Facebook.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.